I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. The year is 2008. The album, Do You Believe in Gosh? The artist, Mitch Hedberg, and my guest this week is Andrew Husband. Thanks so much for doing the show.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
So, all right, let's start with who you are, what you do, what you write, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure. I work for a website called uprocks.com. I'm a staff writer there, but I spend a good chunk of my time writing about stand-up, about comedy, especially stand-up comedy and streaming. So, like, pretty much anything that's popping up on Netflix, which at this rate is, like, two new ones a week.
Insane.
But, yeah, it is insane. But it keeps me busy. So that's the gist of what I do in a professional sense, at least when it comes to comedy.
How?
Telling jokes, actually being funny, I don't do that at all.
Well, this is what I'm always interested in, is how people, I mean, I say that, I'm not a stand-up, I do comedy of my own kind, but I also do sit and, like, pick people's existing comedy apart, and so I know why I'm interested, and I'm wondering if you have just always been a comedy fan. And in what way, like, where did it come from first for you?
Yeah, I think it starts from the place of being a fan, being someone, being in the audience, just listening to comedy albums, like whatever, like my parents had essentially, which was a lot of Lewis Black, a lot of Carlin, that kind of stuff, CDs, vinyl, etc. And so I grew up like sort of just listening to it as a fan. But I think that's not to say that like a comedian can't be a critic and a critic can't be a comedian.
Sure.
I don't think that kind of distinction really exists. But I used to work in academia. I used to be a literary critic essentially. So that's how I was trained. So when I approach comedy in the sort of the same way, I'm trying to appreciate this, to understand it, to critique it, see how it works, that sort of thing, and appreciate it. But at the same time, I know I'm not good at replicating it or reproducing it. And even if I try, that's going to be somewhere else. So in that way, I sort of keep them separate in my head, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. Wow, I don't often get to actually talk to somebody who is strictly academic.
Former. I quit the ivory tower of academia because it was making me so much money to instead write for the internet. So yeah, you know, I made good life choices.
But I mean, in that you're still analyzing it, I guess I conflate academia with just continuing to write about shit. Cause I'm not an academic, but if I could have a degree in comedy albums, I feel like, that's something I could probably, nail down if I wanted to.
Yeah.
So, so while not an academic, you're definitely sitting and thinking about comedy a hell of a lot, which some people think is antithetical to appreciating it, which I actually disagree with thoroughly. I love the idea of sitting and thinking about it or bullshitting about it with people because, I mean, what's wrong with understanding something you love?
No, right on. I get enjoyment not just from, being a member of the audience, either at home or at an actual comedy club or a show, but going back and, rewatching or re-listening to something and thinking about, what it is that the comic does or why I laughed at a certain part and not another. Like I get enjoyment out of that too. And I think when you do that, not like in a professional sense like I do, but even just as an audience member, when you sort of think about what makes you laugh, it sort of helps you both understand what entertains you and what doesn't, but also why you like certain performers and jokes and why you don't and so on and so forth. I don't know. I think there's value in that.
Where did you first hear this album, and was it the first time you'd heard Mitch Hedberg, or were you already a fan?
I was already a fan of Mitch. I'd never actually really listened to any of his albums initially. When I first discovered him, it was when YouTube was really starting to become a thing, and I think he was one of the first comedians whose snippets from like his Comedy Central half hours and stuff like that were being uploaded and just watched gazillions of times, like him. And there's a lot of Lewis Black up there. And yeah. I have a few fellow comedy journalists who know way more about this stuff and have written about it. And I'm blanking on their names, and I'm sure I'll figure it out by the end of this. Mm-hmm. But Mitch was one of those. And I remember, like, you know, being, you know, a stereotypical stoner undergraduate, finding these videos of Mitch, and you know, sharing them with my buddies, like, this guy's great, man. And then, like, you know, seeing it replay on Comedy Central late at night. But I'd never listened to his albums. And then when Spotify first became a thing, I guess in like, it must have been like 2011, 2012, mm-hmm. something like that. They had all of his albums on there. And I was doing this long road trip. And so I put all the Mitch Hedberg stuff in the playlist. And it went through all of it, but it went through Do You Believe in Gosh? And I had never heard any of it. And I was like, oh, this is great. This is cool. It's a little raw. It's mm-hmm. it's not as like stereotypical Mitch, you know, that we all think of, that he's just really going from one one-liner to another. There's like crowd work. There's all this other extra stuff. And it was only after I listened to it that I realized, oh, yeah, because this was put out after he died. And this is recordings of shows that were in process. And that's why it sounds like that.
Yeah, I love that quality to it very much. I like that it's raw. I mean, what's funny is I don't think he was ever very good at segues necessarily, but I love listening to him either not even bother to segue or just say like, oh, that fucking joke sucked. Just beat up his own jokes. And it's very charming, if nothing else.
Well, he's very, it's something that I've found both in listening to Do You Believe in Gosh, but also the sort of the collected vinyl set that Comedy Central Records put out a couple years ago. In addition to having this and the other two records that came out when he was alive, his wife, Lynn, and Comedy Central Records put out some other recordings on there, including like just like tapes he was making so he could go back and listen to it and refine a show. Mm-hmm. And one's like a really early recording when he's opening for like a music group, and it's not very good quality. Occasionally the crowd is laughing, but it's very evident that the crowd does not really give a damn about him being there. They just want to listen to their band, and he knows it. Mm-hmm. And he just kind of rolls with it. And it's the kind of thing that you will never experience. You would never experience with a comedian if you just listened to their finally produced, finalized albums. But also, because Mitch died in 2005, without these recordings, unless you'd been to a show, you never would have heard this.
Yeah.
And I wasn't going to clubs and stuff when he was, you know, in his prime touring and doing shows and stuff. So I never got to see him live, and I never got to see him, you know, bomb or fine tune a joke or do any of that. So that's why I picked Do You Believe in Gosh? Because I love hearing it for those particular aspects, but also I just think it's kind of nice to, you know, I like watching the sausage be made. I'm weird like that, but I get enjoyment out of that.
Well, and it's not like, of course, that we're hearing something entirely raw, because A, he's a professional, and B, you don't get up on stage normally if you don't have a couple things that land. Yeah. Right. The problem is, like, I'm sitting listening to him. I'm like, I'm going to take some notes. I don't always take the best notes. And I'm like, okay, yeah, I'll write down the stuff that's funny. No, dumb shit. Like, you'd have to write down the entire, like, there's, you know, you can't write down every punchline he does. Although you are right.
Right.
It's not just one line after one line after one line. I do like when he will stack a couple one-liners that are not related. That is also something that you can't, I don't know. Like, it takes a particular skill or lack of how things land to just say fuck it and do two jokes that are unrelated right in a row without a segue.
Oh, yeah. No, he... I think that's kind of... And you were saying this earlier, but it's one of my favorite things about... Like even the other albums, but especially this one. Like, like you were saying, he... Sometimes he segues, but that's never the thing that he cares about.
Mm-hmm.
He cares like just delivering the joke and then moving on to the next one. And if it fails, then sometimes he makes a comment, sometimes he doesn't. but just sort of, it's almost, it's not that he's ignoring the audience.
Mm-hmm.
He wants them to be having a good time, but he's definitely way more focused on, all right, here's the next one.
Yeah.
Like, so much so that, like there's, so the one instance that comes to mind on Do You Believe in Gosh is the bit about T-Ski, where he's so focused on, like, going through his notes and testing stuff out that he's also sort of just kind of having little brain farts. And so he reads his notes and he goes, T-Ski, like, what the hell did I mean by that? And this, it's not a bit. Like, he legitimately just has a moment on stage where he doesn't remember what the reference is. And then people are laughing at that, and he kind of runs with it. And then he's halfway through that says, oh, I remember what it is now. And then without even segueing or transitioning, just goes straight into the joke while people are still laughing at him forgetting it. It's the kind of thing that, again, it's because this wasn't meant to be a finalized album.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually not the kind of stuff you hear on comedy albums, but I absolutely adore this album because this stuff is there.
Yeah, you know, I'm always... I don't know. I love it. I'm agreeing with you 100%. And I guess what I'm about to set up is that I'm shocked that something like this works. I'm surprised when, not surprised, when people who have material of any kind, of like an author's works or whatever, that were not released, weren't meant to be released, and they either go and finish them themselves or release them as is. And I'm always like, well, obviously, for the most part, this usually seems like a money grab. I don't think it feels that way with this, but it can feel very cynical. It can also feel, you know, it's like, is this the artist's voice when it's not finished? And usually the artist wants their finished product to be something they've kind of approved to the very end. But when you don't have a choice, and when his appeal and his artistry kind of does depend a little bit on him feeling completely honest, in that, like, you know, his other albums, he'll fully comment on a joke when it just totally fucking bombs, or when it doesn't work or doesn't make sense. So it's still in character and it works perfectly well. It's one of those rare situations where I think a posthumous release has, I don't know, it feels just like a new piece in his canon. It's weird to me.
Yeah. Well, and it's, you know, no, you're right. Like, I was just right when you were talking about how he still comments on his own stuff in his previous albums. The one that always makes me laugh is, I think it's the first album, Strategic Grill Locations. Like, only like a few minutes in, something doesn't work, and he just goes, "Eh, these jokes are stupid." And it's so, like, he's legitimately being self-deprecating. He's not trying to be funny, but it's funny.
Yeah.
And there's something about the way that Hedberg delivers those self-deprecating lines that's just, that just makes me giggle. But it's interesting you bring that up, too, with the posthumous releases, and you sort of get into icky territory with, like, you know, author intent. And this is something, like, this comes a lot from my academic background, because when it comes, you run into issues with this in literature in general. And I don't mean just, like, highfalutin stuff, but, like, contemporary writing.
Mm-hmm.
Or popular writing, like when an author dies and they have a lot of, you know, left behind manuscripts that maybe they finished, but they just never published or never got around to finishing, but we're almost done.
Mm-hmm.
There's multiple, even recently, and now I'm blanking on the name of the author of, To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh yeah.
Harper Lee.
Mm-hmm.
Her estate released an unpublished novel a couple years ago. And it was like a big brouhaha about whether or not she would have wanted that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like a very real, it is a very real issue sometimes, because sometimes it is a money grab, like you said, or sometimes it's people going against the wishes of a deceased artist. And with Hedberg, I don't know exactly what his wishes were in terms of the material that became Do You Believe in Gosh? Mm-hmm. I know that he was working on a next album, and that's what these recordings were for, because he would record it, go back, listen to it, fine-tune it, and then record it again at another show. And the liner notes, Lynn helped put this together.
Mm-hmm.
And she talks about how she initially didn't want to do this because she didn't think that he would want it. But
gotcha.
His fan base still is today, but especially then, was just so strong. And they knew that he'd been touring, and they kept asking, like, had he done anything else or was anything coming out, that they said, well, there's a big demand for it, and maybe we can put something together. And this is, you know, this might rub some people the wrong way. It might not. Mm-hmm. But I know that, for starters, the title of this, Do You Believe in Gosh, it doesn't come from anything, and he never even says that phrase in the album.
Mm-hmm.
It's a line from one of his journals that Lynn just randomly read soon after he died, and it just stuck with her.
Yeah.
And she gave the name, that line, the name to the album. Like, that's where it comes from. It doesn't come from the material itself. And then also, it's, even though it's recordings from live shows, it's at an improv club in California. It's multiple shows, and they do this with albums anyways. Like, they'll record multiple shows and sort of piece it together just so that it sounds the most streamlined.
Mm-hmm.
They did that here. So this isn't just a single show. This is the best snippets of what is roughly the same show from several nights. And so, yeah, they worked to make it sound a lot more fine-tuned than it probably was on any given night.
Mm-hmm.
And that might rub people the wrong way. But then you realize most comedy albums or, you know, tape specials, they're not one single sitting.
Absolutely
from
right.
Beginning to end. It's multiple shows, multiple recordings picked and prodded and put together. Not just that it's the best show, but depending on the outlets that it's, you know, if it's still coming out on like Comedy Central or HBO, they have a very finite amount of time and sometimes commercials that they have to deal with.
For sure.
And so they have to cut stuff. So, I mean, that process is already there. And so, like, when people do get kind of cynical about it and they say, oh, well, Mitch didn't even really make this. It was Lynn or it was Comedy Central Records. My response is always, well, yeah, Mitch wasn't there for this, but they are literally doing the same thing process-wise.
Mm-hmm.
That everybody still living does when they're making new albums or new specials.
And I would also say, like, I should make it clear that I only brought that up as a point of comparison, because I obviously feel that way about this. But, like, at the same time, once he had finished that album and he had gotten the money for that album, it would also have gone to his family. So, I mean, I would say she deserves to have the money from his material anyway, and I think it's a nice thing that that stuff was there, so you can kind of leave somebody a little bit of an insurance policy, frankly. I think it's a nice thing to have an extra piece of art that somebody who cares about you then gets to be involved with the release of. So I think that's kind of closure's a hard thing to quantify.
Oh, yeah.
But it's a very nice thing to have, I think, when the person you love is an artist and you've lost them and you get the opportunity to kind of participate in that final piece of art they did. You know, I think that's, I love that about this. And I also love that it still feels like such a solid album.
Oh, yeah. I wasn't trying to, like, get argumentative. I was just, like,
I know. I just want the audience to know that I am not saying that. I know you're not saying that. I just want the audience to know that I didn't bring it up because I'm saying, what a bunch of fucks. Like, I really like this album.
Yeah. No, it is. It is above and beyond all of that. It is a great album. Like, there's like little bits here and there that don't work, but you can say that about a lot of comedy albums or specials that are out and fine-tuned and highly polished. But there's a lot here that does. Like, I love, like, you know, they start with the crowd work with, like, the thing about people being in the bathroom and, oh, are there speakers in there? He doesn't want to do his physical material because they won't be able to see it, and that sort of, even though he's recording it, like, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But also, like, stuff like the improv fairy tale and, like, stealing the bits of the sign. And there's all kinds of just really good, both characteristically Mitch stuff in here, but also Mitch sort of not just doing one-liners. And because that's one thing that I wrote about this in February around the what would have been his 50th birthday, was this idea that, yeah, he is predominantly known as a one-liner comic, and most of his comedy sort of falls under that umbrella. But there's a world of difference between, like, Mitch Hedberg doing one-liners and, you know, the one-liner comics of, like, the 50s and 60s who were telling, like, rapid-fire, you know, like, you know, take my wife, please, like, that style of jokes where it's literally just bam, 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 and you're getting, like, 8 jokes a minute. He's still... Part of it was his delivery, because he's sort of, like, nervous on stage and doesn't really segue and just kind of just sits there waiting for the audience to stop laughing so he can tell the next one. but it's this. Do you believe in Gosh is still Mitch being Mitch, and there's lots of goodies in here that, like, even now, like, people. One of my favorite things to see is people putting together sort of their lists of their favorite Hedberg jokes.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, a sign of the fact that people have listened to this album since it, because I think the 10-year anniversary of this album is this September.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, September 2008. You know, it's not like there's still a debate about whether or not this is a Mitch album. I mean, his fans have already accepted it and love it.
Yeah.
And you'll see one-liners from this album on those, you know, my top 10 Mitch jokes or my top 20 Mitch jokes. And it's great. I love it. Like, I'm so glad it exists.
This is a question that's not going to make any sense to anybody, including you, or the reason I'm asking it, except for several months down the line. I'm working on a project that is, I won't say similar to this because the person is not as well known, but I'm working on trying to work on a posthumous release for somebody from a long time ago. And the only reason I won't say the name is in case some rights can't get nailed down, whatever. But I haven't heard all the material, but there's a chance that not all the material is going to be great. What would it, does it ruin a legacy if, let's say, this had been like a ton of duds? What's your thought? Like, I mean, obviously I don't think there was much of a chance of that. And I obviously don't think it would include the duds, but let's just say that was all that was left. There wasn't a lot of great polished material out there. Like, it's not worth releasing, I would say, at that point, but it had it been released, what does that do to a legacy? I'm curious.
I mean, my first and response, sort of my gut response, is to say it depends on the context and it depends on the person. But without getting into, as you said, the specific person and the context, I don't think it automatically has a negative effect on a legacy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, with the case of Do You Believe in Gosh and Mitch, that was not. I mean, that is something that Lynn worried about,
mm-hmm.
And is a reason why it was several years before this happened, after his death, as opposed to like immediately after.
Yeah.
Because they, you know, she took time to grieve, and they all took time to grieve and also think about it and like decide whether or not this is going to be a good idea. But even that was one of the worries: was this going to tarnish his legacy? But it didn't. I think, like, even going back earlier, we talked about her. I mean, I mentioned the example of Harper Lee and the posthumous novel.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, as an example of how relevant, or not relevant, but how significant that posthumous novel was, I can't remember the title of it, let alone what it was about, even though I did pick up a copy and read it when it came out, because it mm-hmm. was a big deal.
Right.
That being said, in my mind, Harper Lee is still the author of To Kill a Mockingbird, and that aspect of her legacy in terms of writing that book and contributing to that conversation and U.S. popular culture about you know, race relations, that is not tarnished.
Sure.
By that second novel. The second novel doesn't really have a positive or negative effect. I just don't think about it because it wasn't,
all right.
It didn't have that much of an impact. So that's one thing. Like, that's not to say that what you're working on is not going to have an impact at all.
Yeah, I know.
That's
not
what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
I don't think it is a real worry, but I don't think it's just sort of an automatic, like, oh, it's just going to just sully something and maybe we shouldn't do it.
Right. Yeah. So it's one of those things that, you know, I have to think about. Because I introduced the idea, and then, you know, you're like, well, what if all, because I haven't heard all the material, what if you hear the material, it's like, I don't know, maybe I don't want to be responsible for doing that to somebody, and, you know, if it's not great. But it's also at the same time, for sure, the stuff that would be on this, I hate being vague, this sounds so shitty, I'm not trying to vague book on
no,
a podcast,
okay.
You know, but like, like, legitimately, the stuff that was there, this person was proud of, so... that's the next thing, is you're definitely releasing complete stuff that the person was proud of when they made it. So you are releasing something that is them. So then you're kind of leaving their legacy in their own hands in a way. although they had never intended to release that stuff. So it's there are a lot of things that could be debated about it. But I do appreciate your perspective about the Harper Lee novel, which I can only remember the title of after thinking very hard because it's a very weird title. And it's Go Set a Watchman.
That's right.
But that's, again, it's a very weird title. That's why I remember. But there is that to be considered, that not every piece of art needs to ruin everything that came before it. I mean, I don't know that, and we've talked about it on this show a lot before. It seems to be an American thing where "What have you done for me lately" is way more important than all the shit you gave me before. And it's very strange to me.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean, why not remember, like, had Do You Believe in Gosh been a piece of shit, the other two albums are beautiful and should never be sullied, I don't think, if they gave you as much joy as I know they gave me in college as well.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I think it's also, there's, and this is, again, like, from the academic background or, like, mindset that I have, but the more, from the perspective of, you know, being in the audience, and also as my perspective as being a critic, the more information I have, the better off I am, or the better off I think I am in understanding an artist and what they were trying to do.
Sure.
Be that stuff that they published or put out there when they were alive, stuff that came out after the fact. For example, like, for at least from a researcher and a writer's perspective, that's why I'm really excited about there's this new comedy center that opened up in upstate New York.
Yeah,
it's like the National Comedy Museum, I think is what it's called, and they've got George Carlin's archives, like his papers, notes, like all kinds of goodies and like that. No, so to once every couple of weeks or months, audience goer to like a local comedy club or a theater to see comics they know or don't know, that might not mean as much to comedy fans, or specifically Carlin fans, or in my case, you know, a critic or writers. That kind of material can be a gold mine, not to like, you know, try and sully Carlin's memory, but to better understand who he was, what he was doing, why he was doing it, how he was doing it. And I think, and that's like a very academic focus, but even like Carlin, I think it was last year or 2 years ago, I want to say, they put out some new Carlin material that he chose not to release at the time. So I think right after 9/11.
Yeah.
And it was about 9/11, and I think seeing the buildings, and it was some, you know, it's Carlin's already risque, but it was some pretty risque stuff, and he smartly decided not to release it at the time, and then just kind of forgot about it. And listening to it now with hindsight, you know, it's not his best material. Some of it is pretty funny, but also listening to it, I can understand. I can see why it didn't come out in 2001, but also B, it's still Carlin being Carlin, and it's funny with some time and distance from its origin.
Sure.
And I'm glad that it's out there. Like, it doesn't ruin his memory, or it doesn't ruin the seven words and all the other stuff that he did for me just because this one thing came out that, oh, he made some not so nice jokes right after 9/11. Like, I don't think, more often than not, those kinds of things, I think, don't have the negative effects that most people are afraid that they will.
Yeah. When Kelly Carlin was on the show, she told me that, because she actually had the archive at that point, it hadn't gone to Jamestown. She had, like, he held on to every one of his set lists, like, from the Tonight shows and stuff. And it's just like, I was like, oh God, can I go see that? And it almost happened before the museum happened. I was like, that is one of my greatest regrets, that I never got to see this pile of, like, probably handwritten set lists. But now the idea that it's at a museum that I could potentially go to at some point is phenomenal to me. I mean,
yeah. And not just his set lists, but I mean, like, Carlin was, and I most comics that I talk to and I interview and stuff, like, are very much of, you know, the sort of the I wouldn't, this isn't me using like brainy terms, but say, like, most comics today are based on their phones. Like, they take their notes on their phones. If they record a set, they record it on their phone. Some still use handheld digital recorders. I don't know anyone, maybe from a handful of people, who still use tape recorders, if they even record. And then, for that matter, most people don't write stuff out. Carlin was like one of the last big comics. Like he would, everything that he was saying, he had pre-written.
Like, insane.
It boggles my mind that to operate like that nowadays, but that's the way he worked. He was that infatuated with his word choices and how certain words and phrases worked or didn't work that he would write it all out repeatedly. And that's just the way he operated. And again, all of that, or most of that, is at Jamestown. And again, as a writer, as sort of a would-be, you know, comedy historian in the making, I love that. I love that that's there for people to see and enjoy and better understand him.
Yeah, I love it too. And it's so much of what made me love his comedy growing up anyway, was, you know, teaching me to think about word choice, not just in life, but specifically the words he was choosing to do his bits. And then I was like, oh, so I can think about this in terms of how other people make their comedy. Even though I had no interest in doing stand-up, I knew that it would be good for writing jokes, for telling stories, for whatever the hell else I was going to do with my life. And, you know, it's so instructional. And the idea that it exists somewhere, it's perfect. That is like kind of the last vestige of getting to see the development of comedy. And I don't know, like, how many stages you get to see or how much they've got and how much they'll put on display, but I don't care. I like as much of it as they want to put on display sounds exciting to me.
Yeah. And like, to take it back to Mitch, like, yes, this kind of, cause you know, it's one liners. It's like, you know, it's these very quick sort of, you know, pithy jokes, but it's also a lot of it's based on wordplay.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the kind of comedy too, that is not only short and repetitive, but the more often you listen to it, the more at least if you're listening, like the more you can sort of take a lot of that to heart. Like, you know, Mitch will turn phrases and words in all of his albums, but you know, even in, as we hear him sort of doing it in Do You Believe in Gosh, this sort of, they stick with you both in terms of you remember the joke and you giggle about it later, but also you start to question, well, why is this word used this certain way and not another, and things like that. And I that's one of my favorite, that's the comedy that I like, when it's not just, you know, sort of periodic observational comedy that, again, is, it can be great comedy and I'm not really trying to diss it, but when it's evident that there's a lot of thought put into the specific words that a comedian is using,
I just that
does it for me. And Carlin is definitely one of those. Mitch, for the short amount of time that we had with him, was also one of those. And it's when they come around, it's sort of the thing that I latch on to.
I love that he starts this album out by doing a bit that nobody else could do, and obviously does it in his own way, but by literally talking about why comedy clubs have brick walls, and then it turns into the dumbest joke. And so delights me because it's so stupid. And you can hear in his voice, I mean, that's what you're hearing. You're just like hearing, like, it's so dumb that I get to say this out loud. Like, and I love that. Just that, and just for people at home, it's the idea that old clubs used to have a straw and were built in straw and had straw backing up the comics, and a wolf would get up there and he had a bad set and he'd blow it down, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You get where it's going.
Yeah.
But you love hearing him still tell the story that you know is about to happen, and it's beautiful.
Yeah, the wolf's still not funny, but the brick wall is still up. It's great. That, or even like the joke after that, it makes me cackle every time. I mean, it's so dumb, but it's also one of those things where you realize, oh, okay, that in a really dumb way that makes sense when he jokes about door deals. And this is all, like, you know, this is comedy, you know, or performative arts, you know, parlance here. But you know, a lot of, you know, comedians, you know, they tour the country and they do sets. Like, sometimes there's an agreed upon amount that they're getting from clubs. Sometimes that's just a set amount. Sometimes it's based on, like, how many people are there that night. And if it's that, they call that, you get so much of the door. Like, that's people coming in, tickets paid, that sort of thing. And so Mitch is joking about this, and he says, like, the first night, he gets half the door. The second night, he gets 50% of the door. So then after that, he'll have a full door. And it's so dumb. And I'm not doing the joke justice, but it makes me laugh because you realize that shouldn't make sense,
right,
but it makes sense.
I like to think of it too, like, I would never have thought of it unless, thank God, Carlin came up, because if Carlin could have a variation on that exact joke, but it would have been breaking down and examining that entire set of ideas for like a full minute before he even got to that. Whereas Mitch is like, Mitch takes for granted that you've heard George Carlin and that your brain is on the same wavelength as his. If it's not, fine, he moves on to the next one. But it's like, you know, ha ha ha, 50% of the door, you get the joke, moving on. Like, except that I think the next bit he does is talk about, that is, what is it? Something about a screen door.
He says like, you know, he says like, oh, I'll get a screen door because I want the wind to come in, but not the mosquitoes.
That's
or
right.
Some random thing like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's Mitch. When Mitch is really good, like when he has those really great turns of phrase or sort of like bits of wordplay in his one-liners, because of the nature of the format, because he's doing these quick jokes, they're still somewhat brain teases. Like if you're really listening, like your brain will start working. The thing is that Mitch is already moving on to the next one, so you don't really have time to let it click.
Mm-hmm.
Which I don't know if that was intentional on his part. I think it's just the matter of the way he was telling jokes.
Mm-hmm.
But it almost feels like he's sort of like, you know, negging us all from beyond the grave. Like, you got to keep up.
Uh huh.
And I love that idea of Mitch just sort of like not letting his audience sit comfortably enough to understand what he was saying before because he'd just move on to the next one. And
right.
I love it. He's so good at it is the thing.
As you were talking about it earlier, I do wonder because, you know, you never know how much of an onstage presence, like what percentage of it comes from their personality or what part of their personality. But knowing myself as I do, the idea of moving on to the next thing without even giving it time to land or process whether or not it was the best joke or the best told joke, there is an element of that in I have panic disorder and I have anxiety. There's an element of that in life. And I feel like if he was an anxious dude at all, that is the way it would come out in a set. Like, that is an anxious way to tell a joke, except you're not doing it. You're not Woody Allen. You're doing it. You're Mitch Hedberg's version of anxious. And I do wonder if that could be part of it. It's just like, let's move on. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. I just want to get all these out, and then I've done my work for today. I don't know if that's the case, but that's my first instinct.
I do know from, like, again, from, like, what I've read and, like, things that I've seen that Hedberg... He definitely had like an onstage persona,
mm-hmm.
but he was very, he did have like, I wouldn't call it extreme, but he did have significant problems with like stage fright.
Mm.
But he would turn it into, instead of like just letting it get the better of him, he would actually use it in his comedy. Like one of my favorite jokes that he did, and I think it's on, I want to say it's on Strategic Grill Locations. Yeah, he says, I like to close my eyes on stage because I have drawn a picture of the audience enjoying the show more on the back of my eyelids.
That's right.
And it's a great joke, but it's true because he would literally do entire shows with his eyes closed. And in fact, it's a part of the reason he would wear sunglasses so much so
Makes
that you
sense.
Couldn't see that his eyes were closed.
Mm-hmm.
And like Mike Birbiglia got a start touring with Hedberg, and he has a whole chapter about him in his book Sleepwalk With Me.
Mm-hmm.
And he has this great story. Here it is. Let me find it. Yeah, here it is. He has this great story about watching Mitch perform, and he says, during one famous theater performance, the promoter placed a dozen seats on the stage behind the performer, something about making more money by adding more front row seats. Mitch walked on stage and performed his entire show to those 12 people, ignoring the hundreds of people laughing hysterically behind him. And Birbiglia goes on to write that, you know, on the one hand, that's just hilarious that there's these random 12 seats on stage and Mitch decides, I'm just going to talk to you guys and ignore everybody else. And everyone loves it. And it is that I would have loved just imagining that sounds hilarious. On the other hand, thinking of it from Hedberg's perspective of someone who, even though he kept getting more and more famous, was still, you know, often afraid of getting up in front of big crowds.
Mm-hmm.
Talking to 12 people is way less frightening than talking to a room filled with hundreds of people.
Yeah.
Yet he was still able to turn that into something funny. And that's, it's brilliant. like I feel bad for him, but also at the same time, it's that he did that is hilarious.
That's wonderful. You know, and you say that, and I had heard that thing about the glasses before. I mean, I know a guy who tells some of the most interesting, fascinating stories I've ever heard, and I could listen to him talk for hours. Most of the time, when he's super concentrating and he's trying to get the point out, eyes completely closed. Like, he'll be with you, and he'll be so invested and involved in what he's telling you, but does exactly that. And, you know, and stage fright, of course, is an anxiety-related thing, but it is interesting that to keep pushing, too, because, I mean, I've known, like, my favorite musical artist is XTC, and the lead singer, they haven't performed on stage in 20 some years or 30 some years because the lead singer supposedly has very intense stage fright. So to push through it is no small thing. And then to also be funny and still have timing on top of that. Damn, yeah. That's impressive.
Yeah. It's insane. Cause I've seen it a gazillion times, I think. And it was one of the first things I saw when I started watching Hedberg, like on YouTube, like I was saying earlier. He was on Letterman a lot,
mm-hmm.
and so a lot of those clips got uploaded early on, and I would, you know, watch them dozens of times each. And there's one of him on Letterman, it's one of the later ones, I think. And he'd already been on before; it wasn't his first time, but I think the stage fright just really hit him because the entire 5-minute set, like, he's killing it. He's telling a lot of some of his best jokes that ended up on, I think, Mitch Altogether. But the whole time he's holding the wireless mic,
uh-huh.
and his hand is just furiously shaking. Like, he can't stop it.
Oh, yeah. You know, I've seen that. Yeah.
And but despite it, he's also wearing sunglasses. But he gets through it and he kills. Like, and then there's one off joke and he does his Mitch thing and sort of self-deprecates, kind of points out how dumb it was, moves on. But he's got the audience. They're with him the entire time. But he's still, pardon my French, scared shitless.
Mm-hmm.
And because I mean, personally, you know, in my mind, like, I used to have really bad issues with anxiety. Not so much anymore. And also because of the nature of my job and my background in academia, presentations were a big part of that. And I've gotten used to getting up in front of crowds and talking about this or that. It sucked at first. It's not as much of a problem now. But even now, I'll find myself, in order to avoid sort of falling into some of those more anxiety-driven traps of panicking, like mid-talk or whatever,
mm-hmm.
I'm like staring off into a corner above people's heads. I don't look like I'm not looking at them, mm-hmm. exactly, but, you know, I'm not staring straight at them just so that I don't have to see their faces.
Yeah.
And that helps me through it. I mean, Mitch, on the other hand, went to some more extremes, but he still made it work for him. And mm-hmm. that was the key. Like, he made it work in his favor.
Yeah. I'd forgotten about that performance, but now that you say it, like, I recalled seeing that and being like, it didn't occur to me to think too hard about it. And I don't think I knew the whole stage fright thing, and probably should have just occurred to me that's what was going on. But yeah, it's interesting. It does. It's one of those things that adds another layer to it. Have you ever spoken to his widow?
No, I was actually, I was going to try to talk to Lynn, for the piece that I was writing, to commemorate his birthday,
mm-hmm.
but we weren't able to make it work.
Mm-hmm. I just wonder what that archive is. I do. He's one that I would be curious now to compare to, like, a Carlin or any other archive that I've seen. It would be interesting, yeah. to see what that is, especially if his notebook is Key Tree or Tree Key, whatever the hell it was. And
also
just,
the T-Ski.
T-Ski, thank you, yeah. So if that's what it was and he knew that he would remember it, it's like you're constantly living in that state when you wake up in the morning and think you have this great idea, you write it down, and then when you wake back up later, you don't remember what the fuck you wrote. I love that he could base an entire act off of possibly notes like that. That's what I want to see. That's what I'd be curious to know.
Yeah. Yeah, I know since his death, they had, like, they put some stuff on. There's, like, a couple of videos that they made, and mm-hmm. then I think they released stuff on, like, splitsider.com and a few other places years ago, like snippets of, like, journals and stuff. Like, okay. I don't know if I know she has all of that, or did have all of that. I don't know if they put it anywhere or if they published any of it.
Yeah.
That would be like, if that stuff was ever like made available, I would sell kidneys to like get access to that.
I know. See, that's what I think too. Cause like, you know, I know music nerds like ate up the idea of seeing anything that Kurt Cobain wrote, and I get that. But my equivalent would be, you could bounce it off of that, because apparently in his notes he said that Weird Al is just, he's so enamored by Weird Al. I would love to see Weird Al's archives put into, you know, one big thick book. To some degree they've kind of done it already. But I would love to see just notes after notes after notes. That's the kind of shit I would like to see. Or if they did a Carlin book, or if they even Steve Martin. There we go. Steve Martin would be one who, and he's a guy who I know did kind of what you're talking about as well. He was very picky about his words, and like if a single word didn't work, he would tweak it the next night, or how he emphasized it. That kind of stuff is fascinating.
Yeah, that's. And that's it kind of gets, I'm glad you mentioned Steve Martin, because it kind of gets into something I think about a lot with Mitch specifically, is, and it's really easy to do this with, you know, comedians or beyond comedy artists, you know, who've passed, especially if they've died young or younger compared to what their career might have been had they not died so young. So people like, you know, his 50th birthday was in February, and people like to talk about, you know, oh, what would Hedberg be doing now if he were still alive? Like, would he have been doing, like, stadiums and arenas? Would he have stuck to clubs? You know, would he, what would have happened? And one thing that I hear a lot, especially now with social media and Twitter, is because he did one-liners, people say, oh, he would have killed it on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, on the one hand, we don't know and we'll never know. On the other hand, I don't think that would have been the case. I mean, I think he would have been still doing what he was doing then, like, because he talked a lot about, like, you know, people would say, you know, oh, you're doing comedy now, okay, well, like, you know, can you write a script. Like, he's even got a routine about it in an earlier album. I think the joke is, you know, they say, oh, you do stand-up comedy, can you write a script? And he's like, yeah, it's like the same as saying, oh, you know, you work at a restaurant, you're a waiter, can you farm? Like, it's, and as exciting as it is to think about what Mitch might have been doing, he never struck me, at least from what we saw of him, as the type who would do like the gigantic stadium tours. Like, if he's that scared of like a room full of couple hundred people,
yeah,
I don't think he would have been like in Madison Square Garden for four nights in a row.
Right.
And that's not because I think he wouldn't have, the people wouldn't have come. People totally would have come.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that that never, whenever I listen to him and then watch him now, that never felt like something that he would have wanted to have done. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. It makes perfect sense. And yeah, no, as you're saying that, I'm like trying to picture him in that situation, and it's like, that doesn't fit with, again, with what we know. It doesn't fit with what we know. And also the idea, Twitter, there have been plenty of very good comedians who are not on Twitter because they don't want to burn their jokes. And if you're a guy who depends on one-liners, I feel like you'd want to hold on to them. It's hard
exactly.
to say.
Exactly, yeah.
Know?
Yeah, and also, like, and again, like, the reason why the Steve Martin thing made me think of that was because, you know, Steve famously left stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons he did was because he was, like, going from, you know, clubs and, like, slightly larger but still smallish venues. I mean, like, a couple hundred seaters, 1,000 seaters, that sort of thing. And then he was, like, doing stadiums, and it was just too big. And also because so many of his jokes, and the thing with Mitch is, you know, they're one-liners. They're easy to remember. It becomes easy to throw those back at a show, and not all audiences are wonderful.
Yeah.
Nor sober. And he even jokes about this in Do You Believe in Gosh? It's a joke that doesn't quite work towards the beginning, and he says like he still has to work on it. But he's talking about the announcement they made at another improv to not yell his jokes back at him because like some drunk people were doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And just like I try to think about how, because Steve Martin writes about in Born Standing Up about how he felt less like a performer or a stand-up and more like the MC at like a big crazy party. And I feel like Mitch would have sort of probably tried to avoid that, because Mitch trying to do his style of comedy in a huge venue just A, wouldn't work, because not just the stage fright, but B, it wouldn't work because you'd have a lot of people trying to throw the ends of his jokes back at him while he's still trying to do them.
Yeah.
And I could not see that working very well.
Yeah, it becomes hard. I mean, he definitely, you can tell that he started to get audience members who are, you become a rabid fan, and sometimes you don't have a whole lot of, you don't understand social cues, and you don't realize it's not cool to talk during a thing or repeat the thing that everybody else hasn't heard yet or maybe wants to hear again. Yeah, sounds like he got a lot of those fans. And not to shit on those people, I get it. It's honestly most of the time social awkwardness, I think, that leads to heckling. But that would have been super difficult.
Yeah, I always think of it. I think of it in terms of like when you like between friends, or even like if you imagine yourself going to a party and you know a few people but not a lot of people, and you're mingling and getting to know people, and you find out that a group of people there that you're talking to, you all watch the same show.
Yeah.
And you start throwing back jokes and quotes and things from that show, and you all start laughing about it because you know the references.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that times 10 mm-hmm. or 100 is sort of what some bigger comedy acts like Steve Martin's, and in the way that it was becoming, Mitch would become. Like, it's more this party thing, and when people realize they all share that connection with, hey, we know these jokes or we know these references, they want to share them, they want to throw them out there to like get a positive response. But with the comedian or the performer that are trying to do it, it's like, hey man, like it doesn't work in this venue.
Yeah. Do you, off of this album, do you have any particular favorite jokes that still stand out, or something that you might freely quote in a room where there are other nerds who'd be willing to listen to it?
From this album
yeah.
in particular?
Uh-huh. Or
just from this, let me see. The bit about, I don't know why it makes me laugh so much. It's not. It doesn't even sound like a prepared joke. It sounds like him riffing.
Okay.
But he has a bit, and I believe it's on the A side of the vinyl record, where he notices a hat on a table,
mm-hmm.
and he says, either someone at that table is wearing a hat, or that is a really hip table. And then he continues to riff about this hat on a table for like a good solid, minute and a half, like just one joke after another. And it's so silly and so dumb. But for some reason, that juxtaposition of either someone at that table is wearing a hat or it's a really hip table, I will like say that to people. If I just see a hat at like we're out to eat or something, I will say that and no one will get it. And I don't care because it makes me laugh.
Mm-hmm. Conceptually, like it's weird when you have one of those that's kind of universal that you can use either as a signifier that, hey, I know that shit too, or it's like actually works in life. I love bits like that. He does one. This is not necessarily my favorite joke in it. I'm bad at picking them, but there's a really dumb setup that I really like, because there's no way he thinks this. But it seemed like a funny idea, so he has to set it up this way. So, I wish my clothes were made out of blankets. Like, that's...
Yeah.
Like, that's not a setup to a joke, but it is. It's a brilliant, like, that's absurd. That's absurdism that I think anybody can get behind, and I love that it's weirdly accessible absurdism, because that doesn't always work.
Yeah, no, I wish my clothes were blankets, because in that way, when it's nighttime, I'm already tucked in.
It's just like, yeah, that sounds like a chill idea, but that's, I love that for him, that was worth saying in front of a group of people, and therefore that's as much the joke as the joke itself is.
Oh, yeah. That, and because I'm originally from Texas, mm-hmm. the bit about Texas toast always cracks me up.
Of course.
Because I'm from Texas, and I don't know where Texas toast comes from. That's, I don't know what the origin of that is. Uh-huh. I don't understand it. And evidently trying to figure that out cracked, because he kind of cracked his knuckles doing stand-up in Houston for a while.
Okay.
And so he had a lot of this stuff that he would use sometimes. But that joke, it's just dumb and it's regional. If you don't know what Texas toast is, then you just – it goes over your head. Uh-huh. But I will randomly text to that to my brothers, like, just like, hey, man, I really want some Texas toast. And one of them will text back almost immediately, but I don't have a Texas-shaped toaster. And – it's so stupid, but it just makes me laugh so much.
Oh, that's brilliant. I mean, that's, I don't know, and that's kind of the crux of this whole show. I feel like when something lets you bond with somebody else in this way that you might not otherwise bond with them, or it puts both your brains on this weird same algorithm where you're both thinking about the same obscure thing that made you so gleeful at one point, that it's this immediate ability to transport you to another time without being like excessively nostalgic. It's just like, no, this is a very good memory. I'm immediately transported to it. And it's not even technically an in-joke. There are probably other people you could make that joke with, but that's a thing that you can do with your brother.
Oh, yeah.
That's
great. No, like beyond the thing with my brothers, like I think, so the piece that I wrote back in February, it was just this like sort of like longish piece about how, Mitch's sort of like how he's thought of today. Like, yeah, he's a one-liner comic, but he was a bit more than that. That's like the too long, didn't read version. But I quoted some of the stuff that Birbiglia had wrote about it, and I guess he saw it and he shared it on social media, and he shared it, and then in a subsequent message he said, "Hey everybody, share for no reason at all. Don't have to give context. Let's just share our favorite Mitch jokes." And I had to turn off Twitter because my notifications for like the next like couple of days, if not entire week, were just random strangers sharing their favorite Hedberg jokes.
Holy shit.
And not just like the really popular ones, but like some really like out there ones that you would like just listen to on one of the albums and think, oh, that's okay, but there's better ones. But somebody loved that joke so much that they shared it.
Oh, I love
it. I've gone back a couple of times. Like, I can go back to that original tweet or the one that Birbiglia shared, and it's just hundreds of comments from people sharing their favorite Mitch jokes. It's like one of those things where usually social media is just a giant trash fire, but there's not a single negative comment in this entire thing. And I look at that and I go, maybe we won't end in hellfire. But it was, I mean, that was like talking about like sharing these jokes and like sort of bonding with, and not just, you know, strangers and maybe possibly a few Russian bots, but it was fantastic. It was so great.
That's beautiful. That's so good. If you're going to tell people why to listen to this album, let's say there's some people who haven't heard of Mitch Hedberg, or don't know him from his albums. No, you probably either know him from his albums or his specials. So if they've never heard Mitch Hedberg, what's a reason to listen to Mitch Hedberg? This album specifically.
If you've never listened to Mitch Hedberg, I would actually say, I would even argue like beyond that, I would just say instead of starting with the other albums, which came out during his lifetime and were a bit more fine-tuned, I would say start with Do You Believe in Gosh, because it is more raw, and because it sounds, and because Mitch was mostly a one-liner comic, and so it's mostly, most of his albums are just like those jokes one after the other. Do You Believe in Gosh is not that. It's, there's crowd work, there's a lot of stuff that you would hear in other typical comedy albums that kind of makes it a bit more accessible. And I think because of that, it's a really good entry point for listening to and sort of getting into what Mitch was and why people loved him so much. You do hear the one-liners, you do hear that sort of like surreal take that he had on the world in some of his jokes, but you also hear him like riffing about a hat on a table or people in the bathroom or a guy in the back of the room named Phil who was just randomly shouting at him. Like, all silly things that you would typically, the kinds of things you would hear in any other kind of general comedy album or comedy show. And I think it's because of that, that it's such a good entry point for people who've never heard him. And then once you kind of have that base, you listen to his other stuff, or you watch his Comedy Central half hour, and you realize, oh, I get it. That's who this guy is.
Yeah. That's perfect. I love it. I realized today that I don't think I'd ever heard all of this album before. So I'm glad that I dug in again, because there's some stuff that I had never heard, and it's nice to have new Mitch stuff to listen to.
I wanted to add, I think it also, because Mitch is like, people love Hedberg. Like, even still to this day, they love him intensely, almost to a degree that they sort of like lionize him almost like beyond what he actually was,
sure.
You know, sort of like that sort of hero worship kind of thing. And not that I'm saying they do that in a negative way or a way that like sort of negatively affects his memory. But I think listening to Do You Believe in Gosh, you hear him screw up. You hear him sort of like trip over his own words and like try to figure stuff out. And it kind of humanizes him a bit.
For sure.
And so instead of having like friends or fans telling you got to listen to this and it's so perfect, and then that's what you have in your head when you start listening to him. So then if you listen to another album, you think, am I missing something? But if you listen to this, you hear him, you know, just being a comic trying to make things work. And I think it sort of helps deflate the saintliness that he has. And then once you listen to everything else, you sort of realize, oh no, he is really good, and what everyone else is saying is right on. But it's not like you're not like entering with it being just this perfect image of him. You sort of like get to see it from the ground up, the way that fans back in the 90s and 2000s did.
That's pretty good. No, that's actually a perfect reason to listen to this. There are not a lot of examples of comedy albums where we can give that's a good reason to listen to it. You can be like, hey, this is like a progenitor of what this person is going to become, or what somebody else is going to become. This is like legit a guy who's already in the middle of being successful, but still trying shit out. And yeah, I like that. And what's funny is he always seems like a chill dude that everybody wants to be friends with. But also there's that other human level you don't get to see. And it's nice. It's nice to see that.
Oh, yeah.
So, sorry. Why don't you tell people, A, where they can find you, B, if anything's coming up. I'm going to warn you, this episode is not going to come out for a few months just because of this insane backlog and all this other shit that's been going on.
No, that's fine. You can find me on Twitter at Andrew Husband. Husband like husband and wife. There's no special spelling for it. I'm a staff writer at uprocks.com. It's UPROXX. People always ask me like what Uproxx is supposed to be. I legit have no idea where that name comes from, but it's a great place to work and they pay me, so uprocks.com.
Uh-huh.
I write the Comedy Now column there, which is just sort of like a sort of a regular here's what's on streaming kind of thing, as well as occasional interviews and reviews and stuff. That's where you can find me if you want to look me up and find more stuff about Mitch Hedberg, because there's a lot of it.
Yeah, right. That's awesome. I never do this, so I'm trying to get in the habit of it. You guys can follow me on Twitter, jklamm, jklamm. You can follow me on Instagram, where I'm actually doing stuff, at jasonklamm, which is what that should have been the whole time on Twitter, but that's fine. Go to bit.ly/comedyalbums, and you will go to Celery Sound Records, which is my sketch comedy, and I guess not entirely sketch comedy now, record label. By the time this episode comes out, we might have finally released re-released the 1961 comedy album that we just acquired, and we're probably still in the middle of trying to get that posthumous release coming out. But if you go there and you visit it and keep visiting it, eventually it'll come out. Like, eventually these fucking albums will be out, and so will my next sketch comedy album sometime this year. I don't know when. God, I soon, hopefully. That's about it. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for doing the show. Obviously, you're welcome back anytime.
Thanks. I've been a big fan of the podcast, and I'm slowly but surely building up my vinyl collection. So yeah, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And thank you guys for listening. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klamm. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on Facebook.com/ComedyOnVinyl, Twitter @ComedyOnVinyl, and find everything else at ComedyOnVinyl.com.
A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit StandUpRecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune into the new Stand Up channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast.